From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Hey, L.A., wake up! The Dodgers are alive! Ahead on Only a Game, Los Angeles' amazing pennant run. Also, the Rays sting the Red Sox and the Yankees on their way to the top of the American League East. Lawn bowling looks for young rollers, and a conversation with W.D. Wetherill, author of Soccer Dad. Also ahead, harness racing purses increase thanks to railbirds turned casino rats.
We have two different types of clientele. Is there crossover? Yes, there's crossover. There's much more crossover from the racing people who will go in and play video gaming machines.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The Angels are a lock, of course. They're several laps ahead. The Padres, on the other hand, are quite distinctly dead. But here's the larger news for California's Southern Lodgers. This fall, when playoff fever strikes, those fans can cheer the Dodgers. Having played most of the season as if they'd be satisfied to finish at 500 or worse, over the past 2 weeks, said Dodgers have streaked into first place in the decidedly discouraging National League West, and they seem likely to hold on to their lead. Joining me now to discuss how L.A. has dodged disappointment, at least temporarily, is Dylan Hernandez of the Los Angeles Times. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me on, Bill.
To what extent has the recently acquired Manny Ramirez, late of the Red Sox, been responsible for the reanimation of the Dodgers?
Even after Manny came in, I mean, the reality is they've more or less still been a 500 team. You know, I think the biggest impact that Manny's had has really been, well, you know, obviously, I mean, his numbers have been great, but he's also just kind of livened up the mood of the clubhouse, I think. Before, you know, the leaders on the team were really Nomar, Garcia Parra, and Jeff Kent, who were guys that kind of more kept to themselves. And it was a little bit more of a serious type of atmosphere in there. And, you know, now with Manny in there, there's music before the games. People are smiling. You know, they're laughing in the dugout, even, you know, during the games when they're losing. They have a young team that's kind of looking for a leader. And so this is kind of the right situation for him right now. You know, and obviously, he came here with 2 months left. He's playing for a contract next year. The biggest thing is actually the fact that Arizona is just kind of more collapsed. You know, and I mean, the Dodgers are on a pretty good streak right now, but, you know, they had six games against the Padres. You know, they played against Arizona, you know, where Brandon Webb and Dan Heron aren't quite themselves right now. So it's, again, it's kind of hard to tell if this team's actually good or if they're just facing a lot of bad pitching right now.
Well, it's interesting that you said Manny Ramirez livened up the clubhouse. He certainly did that in Boston. You know, when things would get solemn and grim, he'd ask to be traded and everybody would laugh and they'd move on and win some games.
Yeah, and, you know, he's very different, I think. You know,
I remember
they had just, just a couple weeks ago, they were in Arizona. They had just lost 8 games in a row. The next day, they finally snapped this eight-game losing streak. And I remember asking Manny, you know, something along the lines of, you know, are you relieved? Are you happy? That kind of thing. And he just kind of looked at me and was like, he kind of shrugged and said, no, the same, you know. And I asked a couple more questions, and eventually I asked him, you know, so win or lose, you feel the same way? And he's like, yeah, pretty much.
Well, based on what you're saying, Dylan, I guess I'm not going to be reading a lot of stories about how Joe Torre has finally figured out how to motivate the Dodgers.
It's been a challenging year, I think, for Joe. It started out, you know, even in spring training, you know, he comes in and then there was a trip to China. And they took a split squad, and really there were only two, you know, regular players that went on that trip, Matt Kemp and Andrew Jones. And, you know, Joe being the manager obviously had to go with them, and that took him away from the team, you know, from the core of the team for a couple of weeks. The season starts, and, you know, you have a lot of kids who are still kind of learning the game. And it's really kind of been this up and down type of thing. You know, I think around the All-Star break, you know, a lot of the players started saying that they kind of started getting, you know, the little things that Joe Torre and Larry Boa were trying to preach to them, you know, about just doing kind of the little things in the game, so to speak. Torre himself has acknowledged that that's actually been one of his big challenges this year, and just trying to connect with these kids. I mean, these kids are a lot younger. You know, this is a much younger team than Joe had in New York.
The Dodgers have been mediocre at best for much of the season. I'm wondering what the impact of that performance has been on their fans. Are they discouraged, or are Dodger fans just happy that their team apparently will be good enough to be playing in October?
It's interesting. You know, if you look at, like, the city of Los Angeles, I mean, really, you have the Lakers, and then maybe you could argue that the second most popular team there is the Mexican national soccer team, and then the Dodgers. You know, they're always going to draw their, like, 3.5. You know, attendance is slightly down this year, but that seems to be more, you know, of a reflection of the, you know, the economic state right now, maybe gas prices. And they also raised ticket prices considerably, you know, in the better seats. You know, so I think that, you know, that's all kind of contributed to, like, the decline in attendance. But, you know, if you really look at it, I mean, they've won one playoff game in the last 20 years, and they've kept drawing fans.
Assuming that the Dodgers make the postseason, they're probably going to have the worst record of any playoff team. How likely are they to beat a team or two that's had a much better season?
You know, I think, you know, the way we have it lined up right now, it looks like they're going to face the Cubs. You know, and if in a short series, I mean, you never know, especially with, you know, we don't know exactly what's going on with the front end of the Cubs rotation there. You know, so I mean, if you know Sombrano doesn't come back, you know, if he's having some health issues, I mean, 5-game series, you never know.
Looking ahead, what do the Dodgers have to do to become something more than the least bad team in a discouraging division? Do they try to keep Manny around, or what else do they do?
I think, I mean, really, it's going to come down to pitching. You know, and I think the big addition that they're going to have is when they activate Takashi Saito this weekend. That's scheduled to happen. And, you know, really, Saito went down about a month and a half ago, 2 months ago. And really, he has, you know, that really just kind of knocked everybody back in the bullpen, which really has been the strength of the team. So I think, you know, they get Saito back. Hopefully, you know, that if the pieces in the pen can kind of, you know, maybe, you know, get readjusted to, you know, where they were before. I think that's going to be, you know, the key to this team and how they go on in the postseason.
Dylan Hernandez writes about the Dodgers for the Los Angeles Times. He joined me from Denver, where tonight the Dodgers will play the Rockies if the weather cooperates. Dylan, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thanks so much, Bill.
On Tuesday afternoon, it rained steadily enough in Boston to cancel batting practice before the 7 o'clock game between the Red Sox and the Tampa Bay Rays, who led the Sox by half a game in the American League's Eastern Division. While water puddled on the white tarp that covered the infield, in the visitors' clubhouse, the young and younger Rays watched Mel Gibson pretend to be a Revolutionary War hero on a big-screen TV. Don Zimmer, 77, is apparently not a Gibson fan. He sat in a corner behind the TV screen. Zimmer, former manager of 4 different major league teams and coach with several more, holds the title of senior advisor with the Rays. When I approached him with a question, he had some advice for me.
Well, the best thing for you to do is go around and ask him the guys that play.
I assured Mr. Zimmer that I intended to do just that, but I was also anxious to get his take on the Rays. Experience counts for something, and Don Zimmer has been associated with Major League Baseball in one capacity or another since 1954. Eventually, he surrendered.
Well, first of all, I mean, we've had a great year. The way I look at it, it's September. I don't even know what date it is, but we're still half a game in first place. Whoever thought that would happen?
Certainly nobody familiar with recent baseball history would have thought it. The Rays are in their 11th year. Over their first 10 seasons, they finished next to last once and last 9 times. Going into Tuesday night's game, the current team had been mysteriously imitating the Rays of old for a week or so, losing 4 straight and 6 of 7. The skid was enough to make me wonder whether maybe the Rays had collectively decided, perhaps unconsciously, that they had in fact had a great year already, no matter what happened from then on. Relief pitcher Dan Wheeler set me straight on that.
No, I don't think anybody's satisfied in here until we get to the playoffs, and I think that's, you know, whether you're an older veteran guy or a young guy. I mean, we're here to finish this off, and we've played, you know, great baseball all year, and I think, you know, our mindset still is, you know, on getting to the playoffs and, you know, winning the East, and I don't think anybody's, you know, satisfied with anything less.
Short on offense, the Rays hadn't a single 300 hitter in Tuesday night's lineup, and experience, Tampa Bay would appear to have succeeded on pitching, defense, and enthusiasm this season. To that formula, pitcher Andy Sonnenstein, a second-year player who leads the team with 13 wins, would add an apparently limitless supply of unlikely reinforcements.
I like to think that we kind of still are the underdogs, and we've had numerous numbers of young guys step up on their maturity level and their, you know, skill level. And that's how we've been doing it all year as a team effort. We're really deep in the minor leagues as well. There's a lot of guys that we can call up.
One of those minor league guys, Dan Johnson, got called up to the Rays from AAA on Tuesday. Tampa Bay manager Joe Maddon had intended to start him, but Johnson's flight was delayed by weather and the game began without him. By the time he was called upon to pinch hit in the ninth inning, however, somebody had passed Dan Johnson the script for Tampa Bay's season. He hit a home run to tie the game, which the Rays eventually won 5-4, and the ball club had yet another young guy to thank. Still, it's old guys who speak with wisdom, isn't it? Old guys are more likely to foresee what'll happen down the stretch run of the regular season and beyond. So when I wanted a considered opinion about whether these Rays would continue to play like contenders as the days of the regular season dwindled down toward the teens, I approached their 35-year-old designated hitter, Cliff Floyd.
You know what? We feel so. We haven't been in this position. Well, a lot of these guys haven't been in this position their whole lives. And to be this deep into September, this close to make it to the playoffs, you're asking a lot out of your players. And do I believe we have it? Yeah. Do I believe we're a little bit tired? Of course I do, but everybody is. So I think with what we've done thus far, we hate ourselves in the offseason if we didn't give everything we had and know that, you know, we right there and we know we can compete with the guys that's in this league, we can compete with the guys that's in the other leagues and things like that. It would be a shame if we didn't put on the line and go out there and do what we're supposed to do.
Just for the fun of it, let's assume that Cliff Floyd is right. And for the sheer delight of seeing a team that's only once finished the regular season better than last, let's further assume that the Rays pitch well enough in the playoffs to advance to the World Series, and that when they get there, they find themselves playing the Chicago Cubs, who last won the championship precisely 100 years ago. As a fellow who grew up in Chicago, Cliff Floyd smiles at that possibility.
Sounds great to me. I'm going home to my hometown. You know, people will be there. The city of Chicago will shut down for a couple days. It will be great.
Once again on Wednesday night, Floyd and his teammates did their part to advance the American League half of that potential matchup. The Rays beat the Red Sox 4-2 in 14 innings. Tampa Bay left town with a 2.5-game lead over Boston and every reason to expect to make their first postseason appearance. As our listeners know, I'm not the most tech-savvy guy, and I'm still struggling with the definition of the podcast, so I'll once again consult the dictionary. Pod, a somewhat elongated two-valved seed vessel, as that of a pea or bean, cast, to throw or set aside, discard or reject. So if you'd like to discard peas or reject beans, please go to onlyagame.org and click on podcast. It's 19 minutes past the hour. While trying to catch a wave off the coast of Byron Bay, Australian surfer John Morgan got a ride he hadn't anticipated. A 10-foot shark surfaced near the paddling Morgan, became entangled in the surfer's leg rope, and began pulling Morgan out to sea. To say it was like being towed by a jet ski might be an exaggeration, Morgan said, but it was really fast. The shark apparently didn't like pretending to be a jet ski any more than Morgan liked the ride. Once it freed itself from the rope, the predator disappeared into deeper water rather than chow down on Morgan's ankle, to which the leg rope was still attached. Said the fortunate surfer of the shark, he was probably as freaked out as I was. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, a conversation with W.D. Wetherill, author of Soccer Dad, A Father, A Son, and A Magic Season. But first, harness racing used to be one of the biggest sports draws in America. After decades of stagnation, trotters and their riders are trying to stage a comeback. But as North Country Public Radio's Brian Mann reports, that effort has brought more controversy than fans.
Cicadas chant in the tall grass as Irv Moran turns laps with his 3-year-old nut brown pacer on his homemade track near Westport, New York. Moran is a big guy, his gray hair capped under a crash helmet. He sits with surprising ease in a spindly horse cart known as a sulky.
It's not a scary thing, at least it's not for me, because it's mostly all I've ever done, you know, so it's kind of like one of the ways I relax.
The 60-year-old Moran admits to being one of a dying breed. He's a small-town trainer from the Adirondack Mountains, a blacksmith, and for decades one of the top drivers in the country. He says taking up harness racing was his dad's idea.
You know, he worked in the iron ore mines, and he wanted to get some fresh air, you know, working underground in the dust and stuff, so he wanted to get a racehorse, and I loved horses too, so we bought a cheap racehorse, and little by little I started driving county fairs.
Moran is a holdover from the last golden age of harness racing, a time when average guys owned horses and raced on weekends at county tracks from Florida to Maine. He keeps a pile of old videos of his big races.
And off, Emil Carter to the Inside Casino winner as expected early speed.
Harness racing grew out of a grassroots effort in the late 1800s to breed better horses for pulling the buggies and coaches that were the main form of transportation. Charles Learson is a writer and editor with Sports Illustrated, whose 2008 book tells the story of Dan Patch, a harness horse that was rock star famous. In the early 1900s, Learson says, the sports fans could relate to the horses and their drivers.
These were the horses that pulled ambulances and the fire trucks and the family vehicles. So it was like being a NASCAR fan going out and rooting for a certain, make of car. It was very much like NASCAR, except the people were a lot better dressed in those days.
Top harness horses were earning more money than Major League Baseball stars. Their pictures were on the front pages of newspapers. But after World War II, America's fascination with harness horses was fading fast. Nicole Kraft, director of communications with the U.S. Trotting Association, says her sport was slowly eclipsed by casinos popping up in places like Las Vegas and Atlantic City.
Things really started to slide downward in the sense that there were other options out there, and people were able to make other choices with their entertainment dollar, with their time, with their wagering dollars.
It's currently 71 degrees, and the track is fast on a beautiful late summer night. For harness racing action, 13 on tonight's live program.
This is the Saratoga Gaming and Raceway, sort of the neglected stepsister of the world-famous thoroughbred track just down the road. On this night, the grandstand is nearly empty.
It's showtime. The Rock and Roadies away well from the inside eyeball. Sporty showing some early speed, splitting pace.
Races go off like clockwork. Brightly jerseyed drivers crouch over the reins while horses glide over the track, wheel to wheel and flank to flank.
That's it. Open them up.
The couple hundred fans who are here obviously love it. But to the untrained eye, the sport seems less exciting than thoroughbred racing and NASCAR. The whole point of harness racing was to develop a breed of horses that could pull a carriage swiftly and smoothly with as little drama as possible. One of the sport's big challenges, says top Saratoga driver Frank Coppola, is teaching fans to see the fine points of competition.
There's a lot of strategy. You're always trying to balance your position in the race and how hard you can use your horse in that particular race. Sometimes you have to take a chance and get boxed in and take the short way around the track.
The 49-year-old Coppola is moonlighting. He also works for Saratoga's Department of Public Works. This month he claimed his 4,000th win. But even in this horse racing town, he's nearly anonymous.
I have pictures of the 80s where the grandstand was totally full up here and downstairs.
That's Wayne Kellogg. He runs one of the biggest tire dealership chains in the Northeast and owns a big harness racing stable in Queensbury, New York. He's got 3 horses running tonight, but Kellogg admits that things were so bad for a while that he sold his horses and stopped coming.
In the 80s, I got out of it because you could have a decent horse and you couldn't stay even. Now, if I have a halfway decent night, I could make $10,000 and $20,000 tonight.
Harness racing may have lost its appeal with fans, but the sport is suddenly rich again. Though Saratoga's stands are nearly empty tonight, the casino is packed. Inside, row after row of eager faces seem hypnotized by glittering video slot machines. Harness tracks across the country have used casino profits to boost their purses dramatically. Saratoga went from $3 million a year to more than $14 million. Boosters say that infusion saved harness racing, bringing back the owners and the drivers. But Skip Carlson, a spokesman for the Saratoga Gaming and Raceway, acknowledges that there's a risk in attracting an audience with zero interest in their sport.
We have two different types of clientele. Is there a crossover? Yes, there's crossover. There's much more crossover from the racing people who will go in and play video gaming machines.
The new casino atmosphere doesn't sit well with many of harness racing's core fans. Sports Illustrated's Charles Learson says trackside casinos, or racinos, could turn out to be a deal with the devil if slots eclipse harness racing for good.
The places that have them are really hoping that horse racing withers and dies, because that just gets in the way and takes up a lot of real estate, and it's a much slower way to lose your money.
If harness racing has a real future, driver Irv Moran believes it'll be back in small towns like Westport, New York, at county fairs and local tracks, far from the big money and glittering lights of the racinos.
Once something's lost, it's hard to get back. But look at how the farmers' market's coming back. And, you know, the pendulum does swing.
For Only a Game, I'm Brian Mann in Westport, New York.
In his new book, Soccer Dad, W.D. Wetherill stays close to home. He writes about his son's final season as a high school soccer player in Hanover, New Hampshire. He's concerned with the team's achievements, of course, and with his son's, but also with the attitudes of the players and their parents as they begin to look beyond high school and, in some cases, beyond soccer. W.D. Wetherill joins me now from Vermont Public Radio in Norwich. Welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you very much, Bill.
You've published 15 books, lots of fiction, lots of extraordinary writing about fishing and nature. What led you to write a book about your son's high school soccer team?
I've been watching my son or my daughter play soccer for almost 20 years now. I think if you let a writer look at anything for 20 years, he or she will write a book about it. So that's going on. I had a lot on my mind, lots of observation, lots of stories. I felt a certain missionary zeal here that soccer, American soccer, badly needs a book of celebration. The literature of soccer in America is really very thin. There are hundreds of books on baseball and football, but few really good ones on soccer, especially ones that celebrate how beautiful the game is.
The Hanover High School team has been exceptionally successful. Your son was on a team that won three consecutive state championships. Would you have been tempted to write about your son's experience and your own as a soccer dad if Hanover had been, say, a 500 team?
I think it's a book about happiness. And is it easier to be happy when you have an undefeated 20-0 team than it is when you go 10-10? I don't know. I'm going to have to think about that a little bit.
It seems to me the ultimate rhetorical question on a sports program.
Well, the good news is I'll never have to answer that.
I don't want our listeners to get the impression that Soccer Dad is only about soccer games and players and coaches. Some of it is about driving to and from soccer games. And I particularly like your account of your trip home from a game at Oyster River last September. Could you read that for us?
All day the weather had been perfect, with a kind of burnished summer feel that makes you feel it will go on forever. A light southerly breeze that wafted monarch butterflies across the playing field. Wildflowers still in bloom, clumped and ready to pick bouquets. Fleecy clouds that look fresh off an impressionist easel. It mimics spring, this softness. It makes you want to laugh, dance, and sing. The realist in you, the Puritan doubter, is simply overwhelmed. But it's not spring. Your spirit is apt to feel wistful, and that's the heartbreaking part of early fall, knowing it's far too perfect to ever last. And it didn't last, not even through the rest of the afternoon. When we came to the rugged hills that separate central New Hampshire from our home in the west, the clouds, so soft in the morning, had darkened to the color of tarnished brass, and we could feel the temperature drop even inside the car. Celeste put the heat on, and it was clear that not only had real autumn arrived, our old-fashioned New England autumn that speaks of foliage, pumpkins, cider, and pilgrims, but an autumn had come with an undertone of winter, a winter of the spirit, that thing about fall that rests uneasily on the heart.
That's just one of the soccer occasions during which you were able to reflect on matters larger than the game. Is there something about soccer that encourages that?
There's something about the uninterrupted flow of soccer that is part of its magic. You can walk around it. You can take a stroll. You can walk down the line and look at it from a different direction. You can go off to the hot dog stand and come back and play continues. Part of that, I think, is what seems to add a certain metaphoric quality to it.
Lyrical writing aside, I have to ask you about some of the writing elsewhere in the book. At one point, you describe your reluctance to approach your son and his teammates right after a game that they've won, and you say you're in awe of the players and their, quote, legendary exploits. In retrospect, does that strike you as just a little over the top?
I don't think it is an exaggeration. That's certainly not the part about feeling a certain awe toward them. I'm not exactly sure where that comes from. Having watched them for so many years, I felt almost like I was watching Manchester United or Tottenham Hotspur or something. They did become larger than life. And I'm hoping the reader understands that I say that with my tongue partially in my mouth. The writing itself is an over-exaggeration, I suppose, but the feeling beneath it is not an exaggeration.
Early in Soccer Dad, you write that you and your son, Matt, had figured out that he would not play soccer in college since, as you put it, quote, the coach would own you and there would be too much else to do in college to want that to be the case. How did that line of reasoning change?
I think I spent so many years determined not to be a typical soccer dad or sports dad, convinced my son was going to be an All-American in college, that if anything, Matt and I went too far in the other direction, downplayed it too much. And as it turns out, one of the biggest surprises in the book is that by the end, Matthew is being recruited by some very good colleges and is playing now in college and having a very good time.
Well, it's good to hear. He's at Haverford College, I understand. And if there is a place where you can be an athlete and a scholar, perhaps that's the sort of place where it's possible.
That's right. And Haverford, actually, its first game was in, I believe, 1905. So soccer there, it's the oldest program in the country. Soccer there is almost as old as football is at a place like Harvard. And Matthew is a real student of the game, and he really values and understands the tradition of it. So, he's found the perfect place.
Part of what Soccer Dad is about is endings, the end of your son's career as a high school soccer player last fall, the end of his time living at home, and also the end of your days and nights as a soccer dad. You write that you're afraid you won't have much of a social life post-high school soccer. How has that worked out?
Oh, it's been terrible. This empty nest business has been absolutely excruciating. Certainly, I've watched all of Matthew's games since he was a little kid, and it was absolute agony not to have seen his first college game last week. I feel a lot like retired people are said to feel, that very mixed emotions, from a certain amount of relief to a certain amount of apprehension. But you're given a certain amount of parental fuel, I think, and you can't burn it forever. And that's what I'm dealing with right now, to come to an understanding that it was great while it lasted, but it's just not meant to last forever.
W.D. Wetherill, who has occasionally served as a commentator for Only a Game, is the author of over a dozen books, the most recent of which is Soccer Dad, A Father, A Son, and A Magic Season, published by Skyhorse Publishing. Walter, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you very much, Bill.
Soccer Boppers. You're listening to Only a Game.
You know, all the rednecks that were calling and death threats, I don't think any of them could shoot straight enough to hit anyone anyway.
That was Don Haskins, who coached the men's basketball team at Texas Western University, now Texas El Paso, to the NCAA championship in 1966. In the championship game, Coach Haskins started five black players against Adolph Rupp's University of Kentucky team. Rupp's team was all white. The hate mail to which Coach Haskins was referring when we spoke 2 years ago on the 40th anniversary of that championship game came from people, more than 30,000 of them, who didn't like seeing a team of black players prevail. According to Haskins, even some of the Texas Western fans had begun the season feeling that way.
I do remember the athletic director come to me one day and he said, "We've got this guy that has this big car company who's one of our biggest supporters, and he thinks you're playing too many blacks." And I didn't change, but when we got on the airplane to go to Maryland to play in the Final Four, I noticed he was sitting in the first-class seat, first row.
Don Haskins died on Sunday at the age of 78. He had retired from coaching in 1999. His teams at Texas El Paso won 719 games. In 38 years, he presided over 32 winning seasons. He took teams to the NCAA tournament 14 times. Don Haskins acknowledged in his autobiography that it was quite a while before he could appreciate what he and his team had accomplished in 1966. "I wished for a long time that we had never won that game with Kentucky," he wrote, "because life would have been a heck of a lot easier for me, my school, and my players." No doubt he was right, but as a result of the achievement of that team, lots of young black men suddenly found themselves hearing from basketball programs that had not previously been interested in them. Coaches and athletic directors began to understand that if they were going to win, they'd have to be equal opportunity recruiters. And 40 years after the 66 championship, Don Haskins was able to put his achievement in a context that transcended basketball.
I think the thing that I enjoy today more than anything else, I had five or six good white players too, and I never, ever saw or never felt any tension between them. Half of them roomed together. They were just a great, solid group.
Don Haskins was a very successful basketball coach. More to the point, he was a man who thought he ought to recruit, teach, and put on the floor the best players he could find, regardless of color. In 1966, at the NCAA Finals, that attitude made him an unusually courageous and determined fellow. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Reside, providing vintage home accessories, lighting, and furnishings by 20th century classic modern designers. Collections on view at resideinc.com. And Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In preparation for World Cup qualifying matches, Coach Fabio Capello restricted the diet of England's team and told the players junk food was out. Lads desperate for munchies reportedly tried to hide chips and cookies in their equipment bags, a circumstance one of England's opponents found irresistible. That explains why fans of Croatia, the team that played England on Wednesday, sent boxes of cakes and donuts to the stadium before the game. "I'm glad that in the Croatian national team we do things differently," said striker Ivica Olic. "We can always have a donut or a piece of apple pie when we want it." Croatia might want to rethink that strategy. England won the game 4-1.
Come on, England, give it a go. Make thy sausage roll. Come on, England, give it a go. Ooh, we got to go.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, bias and blackballing on the nation's bowling greens. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
On Wednesday, Texas officials began rescheduling college football and pro baseball games around the coming and going of Hurricane Ike, which has unfortunately already taken hundreds of lives. I wonder if we'll be looking at these sorts of contingency plans each September.
I think given the fact that we seem to be in the middle of a probably climate change-induced hurricane boom every hurricane season, we probably will. I'm really kind of wondering why they just can't play the Texans and Ravens in Baltimore. I don't know why the NFL is insisting on trying to play that game even on Monday night down there, when at the very least the entire surrounding area is going to be a logistical nightmare.
That's a terrific question. The big USC-Ohio State game will go on as scheduled in Los Angeles. How do you like that matchup?
I like it a little bit better if Ohio State wasn't quite as dinged up. Plus, it's also, you know, it's happening in September. It should happen in February. Southern Cal's going to win that game fairly easily, I think.
If Ohio State is playing away and they win, do they still set all the couches on fire in Columbus?
I don't know.
The street?
I think they have to play at home. I think there's a zoning rule in Columbus.
All right. I don't know much about economics. I haven't studied it since 1966. But it would seem to me that some of the most recent numbers associated with the NFL have given team owners considerable reason to smile. Is that right?
The average NFL football team, by which I include say, oh, gee, the Seattle Seahawks is worth at minimum $1 billion.
That's billion with a B.
The Cowboys, the Redskins, and the Patriots are 1, 2, and 3. The interesting thing is that the two New York teams, because they have new stadiums coming online, made the biggest jump in valuation. What this means to the consumer, you're paying more. They're making more money so you can pay more.
That much about economics, I do know. Since last we spoke, disaster has befallen the National Football League, if not the Western world. Will the knee injury that ended Patriots quarterback Tom Brady's season prevent him from pursuing everything?
That's a plug for your book. That's an interesting subtitle. I've heard that somewhere. No, it's been Antietam Creek around the league the first couple of weeks. Vince Young is out for an extended period of time. Jacksonville has no offensive line left to speak of. Seattle's down to about their 9th wide receiver. And Tom Brady, if not the face of the league, one of the two faces of the league, is gone for the year.
On Monday, Roger Federer demonstrated that reports of his decline were somewhat exaggerated. He racked up still another major by winning the U.S. Open in New York. Do you think he'll match and surpass Pete Sampras' record 14 major wins?
I think he's got a better chance now than he did when the U.S. Open began. He got a break, of course. Andy Murray upset Rafael Nadal, so he didn't have to face Nadal, and he made short work of Andy Murray. This was his 5th straight U.S. Open, which hasn't happened since Bill Tilden did it 84 years ago. So he's playing in the record books right now.
The Association of Tennis Professionals cleared Nikolai Davydenko yesterday of all wrongdoing a year after it detected some fishy betting patterns during a match. Do you figure this had anything to do with the appointment of the ATP's new Director of Tennis Integrity?
I think that the events of the past year probably had a lot more to do with the appointment of Jeff Reese as the director of the newly formed Tennis Integrity Unit. But Davydenko's been hung out there to dry for a while. This probe was a bit of a sieve. So it's interesting to see that the ATP turned out to say, well, nothing was wrong in the first place. Return to your homes.
We spoke last week, Charlie, about Chad Ochocinco of the Cincinnati Bengals. Do you suppose Mr. Ochocinco realized how much it was going to cost him to change his name?
If you had bet me that I couldn't find another way the National Football League could be an anal retentive robotic demonstration of the sports Borg, it would be this one. Before he can change his name on his jersey, he has to go out and buy up all the unsold Chad Johnson stuff.
He just didn't read his
contract. I mean, you're talking about not read. What is that? That was in very fine print in Latin at the bottom of the contract.
I'm sure it was. Man, this is not the employer of choice for
48
athletes.
Bucks a piece.
Because there is no exemption available to her, Michelle Wee has to go to Q school to get back on the LPGA Tour. You don't suppose she'll insist on going to the PGA Q school, do you?
I hope this has been a humbling experience for young Ms. Wee, who still has a lot of talent and can make a real mark on women's golf. She's back on the normal track that young golfers have to get in the LPGA. Perhaps she'll take advantage of it.
Track athlete Oscar Pistorius just missed qualifying for the Olympics despite being disabled enough for the Paralympics, where he's won a gold medal and could very well earn 2 more gold medals. Will Pistorius' exploits help the Paralympics attract a larger audience?
I think certainly he will. I would hope that that it would work generally. I really wish they would move them off the Olympic cycle, though, because I know that the original plan was to have them the same year as the Olympics so as to sort of draft along the Olympics. But what happens is the Olympics end, everybody goes home, nobody notices.
Everybody goes home, including all the people making television.
Exactly. And, you know, Oscar Pistorius has a unique enough story that he's getting that the Paralympics will get more attention than they normally do, which is a good thing.
Lance Armstrong announced on Tuesday that he will return to competitive cycling and compete in the 2009 Tour de France, which organizers must be just absolutely thrilled about.
Actually,
right?
They're not. They're not going to give him any breaks. He's going to have to meet stringent new anti-doping standards, and he's not exactly being greeted with open arms.
Especially by people who thought that in their lifetime they might have a chance to win the Tour de
well,
France.
That too, but the race director doesn't seem to be overly thrilled either.
Lots of football fans like to see routes, at least if it's their team doing the routing. But there's at least one fan of Arkansas State who would like to see his 2-0 team keep things just a little closer next week, don't you think?
Actually, number one, I've been to Jonesboro, Arkansas, so it does not surprise me in the least that the sporting goods salesman in question's name is Hoppy Hoffman. Not at all. So Hoppy decides he's got himself a surefire marketing plan. 1% off after each home football game for every point that Arkansas State wins by.
Mm-hmm.
Win their home opener 83-10.
Oops.
It was a 73% off sale at Hoppy's place. And as Hoppy said, it looked like they were waiting to buy rock concert tickets.
Last Saturday, the women's ice hockey team from Slovakia beat the one from Bulgaria by the tidy score of 82-0. It's time for a mercy rule in women's international ice hockey, I guess.
139 shots on goal. Why didn't the goalie just quit after 110th? After the 110th shot?
Maybe she did. Maybe that's the explanation.
I mean, does that mean that means? Let me do the math. That means she made 57 saves.
And finally, Charlie, I don't know whether Michael Phelps has decided what to do between now and the 2012 Olympics in London, but if he wants to join the police force in Pierre, South Dakota, there might be some interest, don't you think?
Yeah, there was a shoplifter who escaped from the local authorities by jumping in the river and the Missouri River and swimming to Lafourboise Island. They can't find him. Now, I don't know if it's accurate to say he technically swam to the island or almost to the island, given those circumstances, but you can't even call that beating feet.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
82-0. Kill your defenseman.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website, onlyagame.org. Starting today in Walnut Creek, California, about 150 of the country's best lawn bowlers will compete in the U.S. National Open. One of those will not be Only a Game's Charlie Schroeder, though he does now and then enjoy a good hook or yard on, almost as much as he does telling people about the history of the sport. He recently attended a tournament in Santa Monica, and he has our report.
Oh, my goodness!
Got the road.
Oh!
It's a safe bet you've probably never heard of the Jack Beckley Quinnell Rings Lawn Bowling Tournament, but Chris Kennedy has. He's a lawn bowler and lives in Santa Barbara, California, about a two-hour drive from Santa Monica, where the Beckley Tournament is being held. Why'd he make the long drive to play in today's event?
It's a strong tournament with a lot of good players and a really wonderful carpet.
The carpet Kennedy's talking about isn't that Stainmaster stuff, but rather the nearly 15,000 square feet of very short Bermuda grass that makes up the Santa Monica lawn bowling green. It's so green, flat, and finely manicured, in fact, that one bowler likens its appearance to a massive pool table. Today, 60 bowlers from all over Southern California, dressed in white from head to toe, gather to roll specially biased bowls back and forth. The whole setting's a little incongruous. The tranquil green is downwind from a fast food joint and borders one of LA's busiest thoroughfares. It's near that thoroughfare where I catch up with another lawn bowler, Barry Pickup. He's also from Santa Barbara, via Northern England, but tells me he didn't make the trip because of Santa Monica's wonderful carpet.
The money is a factor. Yeah, of course.
What is the first place team get?
There's four of us, and it's $500 first prize.
Because the Beckley tournament pits teams of four against one another, a victory for Barry would earn him $125, which isn't a whole lot. But according to Brian Studwell, the treasurer of the United States Lawn Bowl Association, that payday has attracted some of the game's best to Santa Monica.
This club invitational tournament has one of the more attractive prize purses, so a lot of the good bowlers come out of the woodwork for this one, even though it's just a club social Sunday bowl.
Many of the bowlers here today have, at one time or another, played on the U.S. national team, an honor that Studwell says is sort of a mixed blessing.
Unfortunately, bowling in America has no government support. We are the only lawn bowling country in the world in that situation. So often it comes down to, if you're selected for the team, it's can you afford it, because you have to pay your own way, and if you're a working stiff, can you afford the time off?
Most of America's 10,000 bowlers have plenty of time off and aren't in it for the cutthroat competition. Rather, they play for recreation.
In America, more than other countries, it's a sport for retired people played in the middle of the day during the week.
Consider Samurai Dave Lambert, a longtime member of the Santa Monica Lawn Bowls Club, whose nickname reflects his zen-like teaching style. Lambert isn't playing today. The 8-hour competition is just too much for him, he tells me. But he came to watch. For Dave and others his age, bowling is a way to stay active, socialize, and enjoy the outdoors.
And being able to do it as an 80-year-old, being able to compete, breathing the fresh air, and not being exhausted. I also play tennis, but when I get done with tennis, I'm tired. I gotta take a rest. Here, I can continue on my normal life.
Learning how to play bowls takes about a minute. All you have to do is roll your bowl closer to the white cue ball-sized jack than your opponent. But according to Samurai Dave, to be a great bowler, you must call upon something deeper, something that will make you become one with the green.
You need to feel the earth. You roll the bowl, and then you see how far off your target you are, distance-wise. And then you change in your mind the feel by 2 feet or whatever the change is.
Someone who's feeling the earth today is Nick Savage. After the first round, his team stands atop the leaderboard, even though the 28-year-old has only been playing for a year.
Played golf since I was 4. My granddad had me out playing golf right away, and as soon as I stepped onto this, I pretty much put my clubs away.
Reason being, Savage says, an annual bowls membership costs less than one round of golf.
And that's a big deal for me. And, you know, I don't want to go out and just spend all my money playing golf when I can do this. It's, you know, if you find the right place at the right time, it's $50 for a year, you know, and that's great.
Folks like Nick are the lawn bowling community's dream. Young, enthusiastic, and dedicated to the game. Thing is, there aren't many Nicks. Most bowlers are seniors, and, well, with old age comes, you know.
Our membership is very low. We used to have 300, we're down to 30, and maybe only 20 of those are active bowlers.
That's Claudia Spangler from the Riverside Lawn Bowling Club. She tells me that if things don't change, the sport could soon just disappear.
Because the older folks are dying off and the younger folks aren't being brought in because they think it's just for the older folks. In other countries, they have clubs that have the juniors and the seniors and whatever, and we don't have that here. We don't establish that. And it's hard because sometimes you'll bring in the younger folks and they're too young and the older folks scare them off. It's true.
How do they scare them off?
They don't, shh, be quiet, you're making too much noise, you know, stop running around and blah, blah, blah. It's a sport. And if we stop treating it like a sport, more like a hobby, then it will go away.
Lawn bowling clubs throughout the U.S. held open houses to attract new members. But recently they've had to get more creative to attract the younger generation. In Santa Barbara, they sometimes bowled a Pink Floyd and Led Zeppelin. In Newport Beach, a renovated clubhouse with a TV and lounge gives their club a more communal vibe. Still, the sport's presence in America is a far cry from what it once was, says Brian Studwell.
Came to America in colonial times when King George made a royal grant of land at the southern tip of Manhattan called Bowling Green. There's a subway stop there. It's a little triangle of grass that I visited with a brass plaque that indicates that it was given to the colonials.
Bowls penetrated deep. 8 U.S. cities are named Bowling Green. Today, however, none of those towns has a lawn bowling club.
Let's see, so we got a two there, so that's one, two, three, six, plus three, that's nine.
Because the format of today's tournament is a little unusual, the two best teams don't meet in a championship match. Still, with only a few minutes to go, it looks increasingly likely that the team that includes Barry Pickup and Nick Savage will be victorious.
Grand total 36. Should do it.
And in the end, they do win. $500 split four ways, which is exactly why Barry Pickup made the trip.
That's good. I'm happy, yeah. Yeah, it's $100 worth of beer money.
$100 of beer? How long will that last you?
A couple of days at least.
Why does team come out on top? Simple, Pickup says. Consistency.
If you throw balls all over the green, you may as well, you know, you got no chance. You know?
Right. So
it's a simple game, only complicated by the people who play it.
And that goes whether the people who play are young or old. For Only a Game, I'm Charlie Schroeder in Santa Monica, California. The toucher.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Erica Bailey and from Betty Smith at Vermont Public Radio, Norwich. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view Charlie Schroeder's lawn bowling photo gallery, download our weekly podcasts, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word is from Joe Sigmund, who offers this lawn bowling tip.
You have to be able to read the grass.
And then you address the ball. Hello, ball. Rest in peace, Art Carney. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.